Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jiaqi Liu. I am a senior engineering manager at GitHub on the database infrastructure team, and I work a lot closely with our platform, our core infrastructure, and my team owns our suite of MySQL instances. I am based out of Baltimore, Maryland, although I'm currently in New Jersey right now for U.S. Thanksgiving. Denise, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Denise Yu. I also am a senior engineering manager at GitHub. I work on a very different part of the, the product, though. I work on GitHub Sponsors. My team is responsible for the GitHub Sponsors program, which is GitHub's kind of like GitHub's answer to Patreon, but for open source. Most people probably know that a lot of open source communities do all their development, all their collaboration on GitHub. So Sponsors is a way that you could support the open source projects that you use if you happen to depend on, you know, like the hard work of maintainers for your company or for your personal projects and want to show them some financial support, basically. Before joining GitHub, I worked at Pivotal. And before that, I worked at a financial publishing company, I guess. I don't even know what industry they're in anymore. So I've done a lot of different things before landing at GitHub. I'm currently based in Toronto in Canada, although I am originally from New Jersey. Jiaqi and I are actually from pretty much the same part of the country, went to the same university, and now work at the same company.
Yeah, it's funny how our journey sort of took us on this path. I'm so interested in how you ended up at GitHub in particular, on the communities team, and as an engineering manager?
Sure. It's so funny. Like, I only started my tech career 7 years ago. In 2014, I was in London, actually finishing up my master's degree in a field entirely not related to tech at all. I was studying social policy in Europe, and then I literally had a few months left on my visa and decided to sign up for a coding bootcamp, because what else are you going to do with a spare 4 months at the end of a visa? And it sounds corny, but actually that ended up changing my life completely, because I went into the coding bootcamp thinking I was just going to pick up another set of skills to, you know, be able to write Excel macros or script some of the repetitive tasks that I would be doing in a policy job or maybe in a law job one day, if I wanted to pursue the path of being a lawyer. I had no idea in 2014 that I would switch full time to being a software engineer. So like now that it's 2021, I'm looking back, I'm like, wow, we work at one of the most well-known companies for developer tooling in the world, and we work with such amazing teams, and I just had, no way to predict that this is where I was going to be 7 years ago. But originally my background was in, I studied economics in undergraduate. I was very interested in the policy track. After I finished my master's degree in the UK, I had a hard time finding a job in policy, because turns out there's only like 20 openings that come up per year, and they prefer to give those to people who can work natively in the EU, and I was not one of those people. So that's what kind of got me looking around. I think deep down, I probably always had a suspicion that I would end up doing something creative and technical, kind of weirdly in that intersection. I don't know about you, Jiaqi, but when I was growing up, I was interested in website design from a pretty young age. For all the student clubs that I was in, I did Model UN, Model Congress. I don't know how many of those things you did in high school and university, but I always ended up being the webmaster for those kinds of clubs because I knew just enough CSS and HTML. Like, I knew this much more than everybody else, of course, because I did a lot of Neopets and MySpace and LiveJournal and like designing custom Zanga themes. I don't know if anyone here knows what Zanga is, but it was like the teenagers like blogging platform from way before Tumblr, way before LiveJournal. It was probably one of the original ones. I don't know, you just go on there and just kind of like post pictures of your favorite celebrities and come up with CSS themes to make the font as tiny as humanly possible. What was your journey into your current role like?
Yeah, so well, I know what Zanga is, and now there's Neopet NFTs, so you can get back on that Neopet train.
My Neopets are so hungry. Yeah. It's been 10 years since I blocked in, at least.
I'm sure they live forever. For me, I started out my career as a data scientist, which is very different from my role now as an engineering manager on the infrastructure side. I totally agree with you, though. I think it's so cool to be in something both creative and technical. And I realized that pretty earlier on as a data scientist, because you have to be pretty creative with how you interpret the data and how you work with data. My background is a little bit more, I guess, traditional within tech, or maybe not traditional anymore, who knows. I did study computer science in college. I specifically focused on computer science theory, so a lot less, for some reason, towards the last part of my college career, there was a lot less coding, a lot more writing proofs on paper and pen. And today my favorite tool remains paper and pen. And people always ask me during onboarding, like, what tools do you use? I'm like, no, I have this pen I really like that is from recommended by Barack Obama. It's what he used this to write his books. And this notepad that I really like. I think where I keep kicking myself is while I did go to engineering school, there was a strong emphasis on liberal arts, and I did take a lot of liberal arts classes. I actually really struggled in my liberal arts classes. I think I got an A on the paper like once my entire college career. And now as an engineering manager, so much of my work is persuasive, concise writing. So I'm finding myself thinking back to those college days where it's like, how do I have more conviction in my argument and in writing? How do I get this to be concise and clear? And I spent so much more of my time doing that, but also in a technical way, because I'm making arguments in favor of either technical choices we have to make or projects we have to take on.
That is, it's honestly such an underrated skill. And I don't think that anybody, like, I always tell people who ask me, like, when they're early mid-career, they're like, what should I be doing right now to accelerate my, get to senior faster? How do I get to be an engineering manager faster? I'm like, write. That's my number one thing. Like, if you do writing for its own sake, like, keep your own blog about the things that you've learned, like, write down thoughts you have around leadership, around engineering, around teamwork, like, whatever that is, but also, like, just get better at communicating, like written communication. And like, you know, obviously we both at work at GitHub, and GitHub has been remote first for a long time. That's been the culture. But I have a lot of friends that work at companies that were not remote first. And there was no emphasis on asynchronous communication. There was no emphasis on written communication until COVID hit last year. And all of a sudden, like all the things that people depended on, like in terms of working in person, like that was a huge change that people suddenly had to make. But for us, like, I think we're very lucky that, being in a remote first company means that strong writing skills were always valued. Like, there were always cultural norms about what to write, when to write, how much to write, like the tone and tenor you use when you write. And I like 100% echo that. Like, I feel so blessed that we had the opportunity to, you know, like really sharpen that skill in undergrad. Did you find that, like, I don't know what kind of high school, how hard your high school writing classes were, but mine were so, so, like, not serious. I basically didn't really have to learn until I got to college, and I, like, almost failed my first college paper. I was like, well, B-, which is, like, not actually failing, but, you know, it is for a high achiever, like, getting a B- is, like, it's a bad experience. But like after that point, I was like, oh, okay. So persuasive writing means like you need to form all of your thoughts around a thesis, and you need to seriously like think about how you communicate your thoughts and really like understand your audience. Like, there's so many parallels to product development, honestly, when you kind of like take a step back, like understand your audience, understand their motivations, figure out like what your readers are looking for, like what they're reading for. It's so underrated. Like, I don't know, how do we introduce a persuasive writing component into technical training curriculums? I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. I think for me in high school, writing was always about like meeting a certain word count. Yes. Each paragraph has to be a certain amount of sentences. And it's so not like that in real life. It's so much more on, are you conveying your ideas across to your target audience? Did you think about who your target audience is? And are you making the points that resonate with them?
Exactly. I think like coding itself is also a lot like creative writing. I've seen and heard a couple of conference talks now that sort of compare the process of editing and the process of structuring an essay or like, you know, any kind of journalistic piece to writing code. And I think when I'm like doing a refactoring or when I'm writing something new, I feel like the same brain muscles churn as when you're writing a long form, you know, like a paper or something. Cause like, you have to think about, okay, where are my core ideas? How do I surface those core ideas? How do I make the most relevant pieces the most easy to find? And that's like similar to if you're like naming functions, right? If you're extracting out shared logic and you want to keep like the core logic in the main function, though, you don't want to like extract away for the sake of hiding stuff. You want to keep the core meaning closest to where the reader of the code is going to enter, like that module or that class or whatever. I don't know. I think probably more to pull on there that I haven't fully thought out.
Yeah, I think something we kind of like, I think we think about this a lot at GitHub, but it's honestly new to me since joining GitHub, is the readability of code as well. Is can someone look at this and get an understanding of what is happening and be able to be self-sufficient in that code base? Of course, there's always, you know, documentation and comments as well. But is this code structured in a way that other people can build on top of it? Is not something that I thought too much about earlier on in my career. Just did this code work? Did it run fast enough? Versus now, I don't write code as much as I used to. But when I do, I definitely go through an editing process where after I get it to be somewhat functional, it's like, did I name this variable right? Did I like, do I want all this logic grouped together? Are they actually separate? Should I be, you know, wrapping certain things within functions when they're like loosely out there somewhere? Definitely things. It's almost like I'm trying to like develop a style guide for my writing, but it's also like having a style guide for code as well.
Yeah, for sure. I remember like one of my bootcamp coaches said way, way back when, he was like, make it work and then make it pretty and then make it fast, which like, I think pretty is kind of an unfair word for it because it's not like put cosmetic finishes on. It's like, make your code work and then make it readable, make it a human understandable and then make it fast. Of course, like depending on the domain, sometimes you're more interested in making it fast and then making it readable. But like, I think the order of those two is kind of debatable. But the first one, like make it work being the core thing. I don't know. That still sticks with me a lot. And I think the same, like that's exactly the same as the writing process, right? The first pass is just you getting your thoughts out of your brain and onto paper. And then you go back and figure out, okay, did I do this in the right order? Did I do this in using the right words? Did I break up the paragraphs into the correct places and stuff like that? Yeah, that's really cool. I never really like thought about this in that much detail before. One other thing that we have in common is, so like Jesse and I actually met because of a conference called Write Speak Code. And they do a couple of yearly conferences, but it's a community for people who belong to marginalized genders in tech. Jesse, you were involved in one of the chapters, right?
Yeah. So I was, I actually met a couple of current Hubbers through Write Speak Code. Way back, I think in 2016, I went to a conference and kind of just met a lot of people over dinner. And it was very cool to be a part of this community because this community was so focused on like action-oriented career goals and career progression. And to its name, there's three main areas of focus: writing, speaking at conferences, or giving technical talks, and coding. And the coding part had a focus on open source as well, which I loved. I was really excited to be a part of this community, and definitely has a lasting impact on my career and all my personal career values as well. Denise, how did Rice V Code impact your career?
I definitely tell people that this is my favorite conference to go to. I don't live in a city where there's a Rice V Code chapter, I guess, yet. Anyway, I guess I have some control over that. But I almost discovered Rice V Code by accident. I can't even remember how I found the conference, but I decided to just apply to speak at it. And this is back in probably 2017 or 18. At the time, I was like, oh, this is, you know, this feels like another really cool women in code type meetup. But I didn't realize how action focused it was until I got there and was in back-to-back workshops full of the focus is on professional development. The target audience for Rice V Code is people who are already in the tech industry, but want to get to very senior positions, want to get to the director track. They want to level up in their careers. So it's a support community for people who are kind of already invested in the industry. And I think that's one of the big differentiators of the community. I think there definitely is, there's so much room and so much space and demand for communities that want to lower the barriers to access to people wanting to get into the industry. Rice V Code explicitly doesn't pitch itself at that group because it's, you know, just a different audience. But when I went to Rice V Code for the first time, I don't know how to describe it other than I found so much camaraderie. Everybody there knew what I was going through. And I remember seeing Tanya Riley, I don't know if this is the first time she gave a talk, but she delivered a talk now has been, I get sent this talk pretty often. People are like, oh, check out Tanya's talk. And I'm like, yeah, I know Tanya. She's fantastic. I was there for one of the first ever deliveries of this talk. But the talk is called Being Glue. And I remember that talk honestly changed my life in so many ways. I don't know if you still think about this talk as well, but I send it to everybody. Essentially, the thesis of the talk is that so many people from marginalized backgrounds and marginalized identities will end up doing a category of work on their teams called glue work. Glue work is all the tasks that fall in between things that are considered engineering tasks or technical tasks, but things that are still critical for the team to function as a cohesive unit. So an example is it maybe you're on a team and you recognize that nobody has written onboarding documentation. And the new joiners are having a hard time ramping up because nothing about this is written down. So you might take it upon yourself to develop an onboarding checklist or write some documentation or come up with a system where new joiners pair with somebody old and have a buddy system for the first few months or weeks that they're. But a thing that happens very often with glue work is that you don't get promoted for it. In fact, glue work is easy to mentally anchor on because so few people are doing it, you often get really nice, positive feedback about it, which sounds really nice, but it's easy to write a piece of feedback. Jachi developed this onboarding program for new joiners, and it was so great. And now, people are really happy on the team. But that's not the thing that people get promoted for. People get promoted for engaging with difficult technical challenges, from doing technical leadership, and for doing things that are hard to write about and hard to give feedback about. So glue work is one of those things that I am so conscious of for my own career. And as a manager now, I'm conscious about, I pay attention to who's doing the glue work. And if I see someone doing too much, I sort of tell them hey, I want you to prioritize, I want you to know that the things that we promote people for, at this organization, I'm not saying GitHub in particular, but most tech companies promote people for delivering on technical work. You can do a certain amount of glue work, especially I've actually found over the years that doing a certain percentage of glue work actually makes me happier to come into work. There was a time that I kind of swore off of glue work. I was like, I'm not going to do this anymore until I get promoted to senior, until I get this or that. But I found that swearing off at 100% actually made it kind of sucked coming to work every day because people were unhappy. I saw the team wasn't cohesive and nobody else thought it was a problem worth solving. And I was but I care about my team being happy, people being unhappy around me. like brings me down. So it makes me want to come to work less and be less motivated to actually do a good job to like, you know, get the technical achievements that I like might need to get the promotion. So like I've sort of like figured out my own balance, but I definitely encourage people to, you know, think about the balance of technical work versus non-technical work that you want to invest your time in, and do it whatever percentage you choose, like do it deliberately. Don't let yourself keep getting suckered into glue work because there's no one else doing it. Because the worst thing that'll happen is things will just go back to the way that they were before. Like you won't get penalized for doing the same as everybody else. That was a very long explanation of like the being glue talk, but I think about that a lot. And like that was 100% a write, speak, code insight. I don't think I would have come across the concept, like come across a whole cohort of other people going through exactly the same problems in their careers without having heard that talk, without having been in the room when, you know, like the follow-up discussion happened for it. So that's like one very, very big way that I think Write, Speak, Code changed my life. There's like more examples of talks like that. But conference speaking as well. Jachi, do you want to talk a little? So you've spoken at Write, Speak, Code before in other places. How do you think that conference speaking has affected your trajectory, or, you know, like the shape of your career as an engineer?
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. I love how Tanya put a name to glue work, because mm-hmm. before that, it's, you kind of have this inkling that like, oh, this isn't helping my career, but you didn't really know why or mm-hmm. like what to call it even. I actually yeah. think maybe this is funny, but I actually think conference speaking can sometimes be like glue work. You get a lot of recognition for it, and people really respect it, but it's not what's going to help you get the next job or get promoted. But it does help you build up that skill set of public speaking, which is really important even within, you know, your day job too. You're yes. ultimately going to have to present your ideas in front of other people, and feeling comfortable in that setting is really important. And then secondly, it kind of gives you your own brand recognition. The more you speak at conferences, I think the more people will seek you out, either for the ideas that you're presenting or to speak at future conferences where you get to meet other people. It is a really great way to network, especially for me, being very introverted. I'm not going to walk up to someone at a conference and introduce myself, but if I'm a speaker at that conference, other people are coming to you. So I do think speaking, you know, while it's a little bit like nebulous, you don't know if it'll get you the next opportunity. It does present you as a subject matter expert within the community. And then that sort of opens up, you know, many different opportunities that you otherwise might not have known about.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I think about a lot is like sort of decoupling your personal brand from your brand within a company. So I like, I empathize so hard with what you said around like doing a conference talk or even like keynoting a conference might not be the thing that gets you promoted within your current company, but it's going to set you up for bigger opportunities in the future, even if you can't see exactly what form that takes just yet. I will say, maybe this is like, I shouldn't say this because I'm not a lawyer, but I have like heard a lot of evidence that having conference being under your belt and published writing and things like that in books and magazines and like white papers helps a lot for getting those like fancy visas. If you ever want to like work in the UK or the US or the EU or someplace where you might need like, you know, evidence of being a established professional in your field, that actually does help a lot for that. Yeah, conference speaking has definitely been such a big part of my career. I can't really imagine what my tech career would have looked like without it. I also hate going up to people at conferences. So like being a speaker, honestly, is like the best life hack ever for being an awkward person who like hates unstructured interaction. People literally just come up to you and are really nice to you. What have been your best conference speaking experiences so far?
Well, I guess Write, Speak, Code like has been amazing. I actually think one of the things I'm still thinking about is the first time I spoke at OSCON. I actually gave a talk that I had already given before, so I felt more comfortable with it, but it was twice as long as the version that I gave before, so I still spent a lot of time working on it. I think OSCON, which is the open source conference hosted by O'Reilly, was really inspiring to me, because at the time I was thinking about how I can get more involved in open source, what that open source community looks like, trying to engage with maintainers of specific open source projects that I was really interested in. And it is really, yeah, conferences do open up those kind of opportunities. At RightSpeakCo, that was the first time I ever made a PR to an open source project, because I was literally sitting next to a maintainer and we were working together to get the CI to pass, get the PR to merge. And I do think that having that connection was really helpful, and meeting all these open source maintainers that helped me get a better understanding of the open source community itself.
Yeah. Do you do much open source work these days?
No, so I sadly don't. I just don't have like the bandwidth. And I think this is a common theme across open source now. It's actually very hard to find maintainers and, you know, contributors, especially given the burnout from COVID. In my previous role, I was working on an open source project. So this is where it's a little bit different for me. It was the challenge, I think, with open source, true open source, is it's actually really hard to prioritize, because everything on your roadmap is community driven, and it's all coming from someone needed this for their work, for their research, for their own open source project. And there's a lot of like motivation to push yourself to satisfy the needs of the community. But you also have to restrict your own, you know, capacity and bandwidth, and really focus on, this isn't realistic for the project to have such a large roadmap. What can we narrow down to what we can deliver that still adds value to the community, but is tangible for us? So to that sense, it's actually, I find it easier in corporate to prioritize, because everything is more metrics or revenue driven. And I think at GitHub, it's a little bit different, because there's a lot of our roadmap that's also community driven. But that's something that I find very interesting, is how do you balance the needs of others versus your team's needs and you know, your own like capacity?
Yeah, that's something that I still don't have very good answers for. I mean, like besides when I was at Pivotal, I actually did a very, very short rotation as a product manager, which is like not a thing that I was supposed to be able to do. We just happened to run out of PMs at one point, and I was like, can I do it for a couple of months? And they let me. but I like learned so much when I was in that role. My main takeaway is that PMs, like, it's just, you get decision fatigue so easily. And I think a lot of the role is just building up stamina to keep making decisions in sometimes with like very, very little certainty. Like you have to get comfortable with just picking a decision, understanding what your escape valves are, and just like rolling with it until you see one of your kind of like, you know, you have to come up with circuit breaking criteria ahead of time. But like, okay, if we see this sign of failure or that sign of failure, then we revert, we go back, we try something else. Yeah, it's very interesting. I don't know like how much of that you get to do as an EM now, but I do a little bit of it. Like obviously I work in partnership with my product manager and my design and research team. But yeah, I think making decisions is probably one of the hardest. Having to make decisions when you are, you know, at best making an educated guess is, I think, one of the hardest parts of being in leadership in engineering.
Okay, that said, I kind of want to close this out with something that's been on my mind is, how do you make decisions about your own career? How do you, weigh those, and how do you like actually drive your career?
So hard. I feel like you have thoughts first. Do you want to talk through that first?
Yeah, I think for me, it's actually very similar. Is I want to stay open-minded and willing to try anything, but also sort of have those escape valves or know like my barriers. Like, you know, if, I mean, I do find being an engineering manager really fulfilling and really exciting. And I see a lot more areas of opportunity for me to grow. But if for whatever reason I wanted to go back to being an individual contributor, I know that that's an option. And having those like safety mechanisms of, if this happens and here are certain options I can explore, makes me feel really good about my decisions and going all in on, you know, people management and learning those set of skills, and knowing that if I, for whatever reason, this is not the path I want to go on anymore, I can't go back to being an individual contributor. What's always been hard for me, though, is picking, as an individual contributor, picking an expertise or topics go in depth on, because I kind of want to go in depth on everything, but you really do need to spend some time on a topic to like really feel or get to the point even of knowing like, here's all the things I don't know that I'm going to have to keep pushing on.
Yeah, I definitely like, I empathize very deeply with a lot of that. I think I try to view every new project or every role change or every new company as a learning opportunity. And I try to figure out like what I like about each thing and what I don't like. And try to, cause like, I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. I don't know about you. I feel like I still haven't figured out exactly what, like, I never have a good answer. People are like, what do you want to do 5 years from now? It's like, I don't know. Maybe I'll own a cat cafe 5 years from now. I have no idea. Like, 5 years ago from today, I didn't think that I would still be in tech. And 5 years before then, like, I had no idea. Like, I thought I was going to be a lawyer at this point. But I think, like, a good way to approach your tech career is to seek out new opportunities, take risks early on. Don't stay in one place for too long. Like when you feel like you have no more hypotheses to disprove, or when you feel like you have no more stones to turn over, that's a good sign that you should be looking for a new opportunity. Not necessarily switch companies, but see if there are other things that you can do within your organization, different roles you can try on. Ask if you can be a product manager for a couple of months. Maybe somebody will let you take that risk. But just try to figure out the different pieces of like what resonates with you. Like for me, with people management, I was surprised to learn that I actually really love the context switching. Like I actually really love working in an interrupt-driven way. I was never good at doing deep focus work. And in fact, like coding was the only thing that could get me into like a sort of, well, I'm playing video games, but like, like coding a hard problem was the only thing that could make me like 3 hours would just fly by like that. But there are very, very few other activities that can get me into that state. So I'm like, well, I actually, you know, like if I'm not coding, then I would prefer to be like responding to different things and multitasking like 4 or 5 different things at a given point in time. That's just how my brain kind of wants to work. So now I have that data point from having been in engineering management for a couple of months. So I'm like, now taking that and like looking ahead to, you know, like maybe running a business is something that I might like to do one day, because that's also very interrupt driven, maybe doing more like leadership focused stuff and even like getting further away from the technical side, maybe, towards the director track, towards like leadership, you know, like higher leadership is something that I might be interested in one day. But I still have a lot more data points to gather. I think like you said, you don't have to have all the questions to ask. You don't need to have like all the unknowns like turned over just yet, but it's important that you learn a few more of the questions that you want to ask yourself with every new environment that you're in, like every kind of new challenge or every new project, every new role that you take on. Don't like take on roles that are not going to force you to learn anything new.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.